Well, good evening and welcome to the Club for Acts and Actors, which is this lovely little place hidden away here in the edge of Covent Garden. And there are three of us in this room are members, and you obviously know that I'm one of them. You would want to join because of the other two, but you probably would decide because of me you don't want to join. But it's very difficult to get in, isn't it, Carol?
Oh, terrible.
Very, very difficult. But it is great to be here. And this is the inaugural in-person, real people meeting of the Great British Discussion Group, which was something I started online in lockdown because I was bored. And was as I think most of us were bored in lockdown, and were just throwing out bits and pieces and got some feedback. But we had a grill. Was it... who was the grill? I've forgotten where you and Andrew had a discussion at the end.
John Redwood.
So John Redwood had
always sparkling.
I can say yes. He's excited the audience.
As dull as
do come in. Hi, front rolling. Yeah, the prize for being a little after the start.
Please meet front rolling.
Yeah, John Redwood had us all sitting on the edge of our seats, and I think you must have mentioned to Andrew something about the BBC. And he came back, not entirely in support, I think. And you threw your book at him and told him to read that. And he still got it. Did you sign it?
No.
I don't know.
It was held.
Yes.
But from that came the idea of tonight. And we are here in the 100th year of the BBC. And we're going to try, not in a day, not in a week, but we're going to try in a little over an hour to actually analyse whether there is a war against the BBC or not. I expect, like me, you hear all sorts of things in pubs, on buses, trains, tubes, and people are always saying, they should do this, they should do that, or whatever. And amongst that, you'll hear criticism of the BBC. You hear the criticism everywhere. You hear it in opposing media. They have a go at the BBC. So we're going to try and address the issue, as I say, in just over an hour, with the help of Peter York and Paddy Barwise, who wrote the book, The War Against the Baby, War Against the BBC. Now, it may be said, we'll hear what you say, that this war's been going on a long time. It may be said that politicians of different flavours have always had it in for the BBC. But when I started thinking about tonight, I cast my mind back, I'm guessing 40-odd years, and I discovered that there was a rather good clip in Yes, Prime Minister. They were discussing honours for an old backbencher. And Jim said, Humphrey, what should we give him? And Humphrey said, does he watch TV, Minister? The Prime Minister said, I don't think he's got one. And Humphrey said, make him a governor of the BBC. You remembered the quote. I could see you nodding. So let me start by asking you, just shout things out. What is the BBC to each of you? What does it mean to you?
Britishness.
Yeah, what else have we got? Come on, don't be shy. None of you are shy people.
Trustworthy.
Are you liking this so far? Britishness, trustworthy.
Censored.
Bland.
Innovative.
Top heavy.
Liberal.
Left wing.
Okay, now we've got a bit of a picture there. When I asked some of my grandchildren this, it won't surprise you that they said CBBCs. And of course,
I doubt it. They probably said CBBs.
Oh, behave. I've given you your credit for tonight. Now you can sit there and drink your wine. They said CBBCs. And if you look in the book that you're going to buy if you haven't bought yet, the heading for chapter 11 is the scope of its activities is chilling. And I think we would all agree with that. Wherever you sit on the spectrum of things that have just been thrown at us, its scope is chilling. And let me just put a thought in your mind to wrestle with during the evening. Maybe the reason it gets criticism is in part because it is so vast. And maybe it's that Most of that criticism actually comes from its activities in news and current affairs, not in other things. So I'd like a show of hands. Who is happy with the way the BBC operates? Well, we don't need a second show of hands. So what reforms do you think might be needed? This is going to come to you now. So what reforms do you think might... If you're not happy with the way it works, what do you think needs changing?
More objectivity.
More objectivity.
Treat people like adults.
Treat people like adults.
Less bias.
Less bias.
More programmes which are aimed at minorities of one kind or another, which of course includes things like third programme, different plays, all that sort of thing, which a commercial broadcaster wouldn't dare to call.
I think you've got enough to get your teeth into there, guys. Who's going first?
I think we have. And in every case, I heard from you things which were unexplained, which hung in the air. Bias, what kind of bias? Top heavy with what? And above all, from you, David, the idea that it's enormous, an absolute behemoth. What would you think was the relative, in money terms, top line revenue of, on the one hand, the BBC, and on the other, Sky? What would you think is the difference, percentage-wise, multiple-wise, expressed any old way, in terms of what commercial people would call turnover?
How do you define that if you've got the licence fee being paid and no other income? We'll ignore BBC Studios for the moment, but how do you define that against a subscription-based business? There's no
Sorry, I'm not going to buy that. Okay.
Fine.
Money is money. You can make a very the point about accountants is they reduce everything to the single measuring rod. You can compare revenue, even if the sources of that revenue are not the same.
So if the revenue for the BBC is entirely taxpayers funded, there is a quantum that is definable.
Not only that, you can also add on the studios.
Okay. So
there is all available.
I think I know where you're going. What is the answer?
The answer goes roughly as follows. First of all, one, the licence fee income of the BBC, which is not from central government. It comes, we own it, as people like to say now, and it comes from individuals via the licence fee. If the licence fee wasn't there, there wouldn't be a pot of money which could go to OAPs or the NHS or anything like that. It would simply have disappeared. So there's no benefit of robbing Peter
to pay Paul.
It's ring-fenced. It is roughly somewhere, but I say roughly because from time to time, quite often, this government and its Conservative predecessor like to do what's called top slicing, to take bits of the licence fee income and put them somewhere else.
Where would they put them?
Well, one of the things would be to take, it's a sort of reverse top slicing, the World Service used to be funded by the Foreign Office. And then the gorgeous pouting George Osborne said he rather that the BBC paid for it itself. So the 250, 300 odd million that pays for the World Service came out of the BBC's licence fee funds. They're always doing that, which makes, at the margin, and we're talking at the margin about the odd 100 million here and there, makes it difficult to be precise. So it gets what it gets after being top sliced from the licence fee, and it's somewhere between 3.3 and 3.5 billion. A lot of provisos to be added. In addition, from the BBC's very, very successful commercial activities, it's after America, it's the world leader in selling both programs and formats.
Sorry, it's the world leader in formats.
The world leader in formats to other people beyond the law. It's really brilliant at doing that. However, because that operational business is a commercial business, most of the returns from that go to the independent production companies, the talent, etc. What they take out of it in a good year that they can put towards making programs or paying people is somewhere around 200 to 250 million. So
that is to subsidise the licence fee, yes.
So when the Daily Mail says, one, that the BBC's top line is 5 billion, and two, that only half of it is spent on the things you'd want it to be spent on, it is not being entirely honest.
Yes.
Just a thought. Now, their relativity
to
I get on.
I know it was your idea, but it is not the Andrew and Peter show.
Right.
Paddy.
Yes.
Oh, Paddy.
Okay, so obviously we both bridle when you use the word vast. It depends how you measure vastness.
Well, I was measuring, I then quoted the heading, the title of Chapter 11.
Chapter 11,
and therefore its vastness is in what it provides.
Well, that's scope rather
that's
than size.
Scope.
Okay.
Scope.
So, and that quote comes from James Murdoch, okay, who's
who wasn't at the time the young man he is now.
He's
repented.
Well, he's a bit of a tree hugger as well, but he was.
He was little
Rupert. At
yes,
that,
completely.
At that. So, if you measure size by the role of the BBC in the lives of the people of this country, and also in the lives of people in many other countries, including in Ukraine, etc. But if you purely stick to this country, the average Brit consumes the BBC's services 2 hours a day. That's vast. There is no other product or service brand in the same league. I guess ITV would be the closest, but it's just order of magnitude, well, not an order of magnitude less, vastly less, maybe factor of five less. If you use a different measuring rod, which is not consumption, by consumption, the BBC is absolutely vast, and its importance in people's lives is absolutely vast, of all ages. If instead you measure it in terms of money, well, the comparison with Sky is interesting. If you look at the last time we had the published accounts for Sky in the UK and Ireland, before it was bought by another big American company, Comcast, then the sales and general administrative costs of Sky UK and Ireland were 80% of the total license fee revenue of the BBC after top slicing. Okay, and that's before the full effect of the funding cuts. The BBC's net public funding since 2010 had already been cut by 30% in real terms, inflation adjusted, by 2019. This is in a market with Netflix, more and more competition, and rising real costs, because Netflix and so on are actually bidding up the cost of premium drama. So what you're witnessing now is a diminished BBC, largely because of the funding cuts. Coming back to the title of the book, when we started working on this together, which was about 5 years ago, people were somewhat dubious about the idea that there's a war against the BBC. No one seriously questions it now. There's just so much cumulative evidence of underfunding and relentless attacks and claims, in particular, on the other point which has come up, is bias, lack of objectivity.
I think some people do challenge it because we heard it tonight, but if I come back to something you said, Peter, I found interesting. I'd forgotten it, that Osborne took away the funding for the World Service and put it into the pot. But actually, you know, if we heard of another country where the government was funding the promotion of interpretation of current affairs on the airwaves,
That's any country with public broadcasting.
Yeah, but wouldn't we criticise? Wouldn't we criticise that country?
Yes, we do, and that's a very important distinction between a state broadcaster and a public service broadcaster.
Yeah,
and you rightly raise the question: hasn't there always been a war against the BBC? Not like today, there hasn't. And actually, the comparison between this government and the Thatcher government is very interesting, because Thatcher was not a great fan of the BBC, certainly didn't, you know, like to be challenged.
But Michael Cockerell sat here 2 months ago.
Yes.
And he told stories of attacks on the BBC.
Yes.
Not only from government, but from all. And Michael's the other side of 80.
Yes.
When he was a young man.
Well, there were attacks on the BBC Michael Cockerell was born.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're celebrating the centenary we're celebrating this year is the foundation of an organisation called the British Broadcasting Company, which was set up by a consortium of radio manufacturers essentially to provide content to cause people to buy radio sets. Okay. And so, you know, right from the start, it was, someone mentioned innovation, it was driving new technology, as it's always done ever since. The first real crunch with government, when it was set up, it was not allowed to carry advertising because the newspapers, and they were absolutely right, said if we have the BBC carrying radio advertising, that will reduce our revenues. Okay, and so it was banned right from the start from carrying advertising, as it still is. But the first crunch came with a general strike when Winston Churchill, as Chancellor, I think, basically wanted to make it a state broadcaster. He wanted to take it over and use it exclusively for the government's, you know, as a government mouthpiece. And that's when he fell out with John Reith. It's an extraordinary thing that John Reith was, I think, only 33, hardly knew what broadcasting meant until he did The Interview, but had enormous self-belief, and he was 9 feet tall and, you know, injured in the war and, you know, Scottish Presbyterian, all of that, son of the manse. And somehow, these businessmen setting up a business to produce content to sell radio sets gave it to this guy because of his self-belief, and he said, we're not just going to play dance music so people buy radios, we're going to do entertainment and information and education. And he sort of set the culture. We're still benefiting from that 100 years later.
I still call it the wireless.
Me too.
Yeah,
me too.
Do you think it should be allowed to sell advertising?
No.
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 And does the audience think it should be allowed to sell advertising?
I'm concerned about dance music.
Well, yeah, I can understand you being concerned about dance music.
Yes. The very
so the audience agree with you on that?
Yes.
It shouldn't do advertising.
It's also been looked at very carefully in Thatcher time by a Thatcherite prof who came from the IEA, the Institute of Economic Affairs, or actually the Institute of Economic Affairs is a set of Westminster lobbyists, which opaquely funded much of it from America. So we don't know why that, but Professor Peacock from the IEA was consulted by Mrs. T. There was an inquiry involving him, and the almost reluctant conclusion of that was that the BBC should not sell advertising, amongst other things, because it would attack the economic base of advertising-based broadcasters like ITV. People didn't want that to happen.
So can we just, let's nail the advertising thing, okay? This is I say this in praise of Margaret Thatcher, that Margaret Thatcher, when she set up the Peacock Review, believed that the BBC should carry advertising. Now that was partly because she sort of hated ITV, so there was another bit of an agenda. Peacock, and completely inappropriately as the chairman of a review, in the first meeting started by saying, we are all agreed, aren't we, that the BBC should carry advertising. I mean, just as a process, and I've chaired a few things, you know, you don't do that, even if, you know, I've been accused of leading debates a bit too much as a chair, but, you know, that's just absolute no-no, believe it or not. But they looked at the evidence, as Peter says, one of the reasons was that they realised that the great majority of the revenue would come from other media which are funded by advertising, particularly the other commercial broadcasters. The second reason was that funding by advertising would give the BBC a financial incentive to meet the needs of the advertisers and prioritise, in general, better off consumers and households because younger consumers, because those are the people that advertisers were trying to reach. Mm-hmm. They actually missed two other reasons. One of them, which is quite extraordinary, this was a group of 12 clever people, you know, Sam Britton, people like that, and they spent over a year on this review. Never once did they pick up the fact that people prefer not to have their viewing and listening interrupted by advertisements.
And on satellite and cable, you can pay to not have the advert.
Exactly. I mean, we have abundant evidence of that. But they literally never asked that question. The other reason thing they missed out is the fact that if you look at the whole value chain of TV advertising, the total overheads in terms of the, you know, commercial production costs, sales force, you know, the different media agencies and the creative agencies, the total overheads is sort of 25%. So right. It's enormously less efficient than the licence fee, which is 5%.
Which is very cheap to run.
Very cheap.
Just to make sure you all understood the relativity, the top line income relativity between the BBC and Sky. Sky's top line, its income, is about five times that of the BBC. More of it goes away in all kinds of spending to run the machine, to get subscriptions, because that's an expensive business compared with a rather cheap business of getting the license fee. But Sky, in terms of its income, is vastly bigger than the BBC. However, it does not spend as much on UK original programming. It buys sport.
In terms of consumption, it's also much smaller. So Sky is much bigger in terms of money, and it's much smaller in terms of
But you can't
usage.
Make the direct comparison because it's got shareholders,
yes.
And therefore they have to have a yield, and because, as you said, Peter, sport. Now, as somebody who particularly likes cricket, but likes sport.
Aren't they doing well?
No, aren't they? Yeah.
Okay, but not everyone.
You know, we do sometimes think, well, actually, wouldn't it be nice to have it on BBC?
So, sorry,
or
are there no cricket fans?
I was only citing sport because
England.
It's
there are some. Okay, yes.
I was only citing sport because it's a ready made.
It's a ready made.
Isn't the radio broadcast better? Because.
Yeah, we're not debating cricket.
Yes. I shouldn't have said that.
How many people watch Test Match or listen to Test Match Special? Whilst having Sky in the background.
That is also true. Yes. We'll come back to that. Now, we've got very quickly into the licence fee, which I was holding for later. But really, it came from something you said and from the audience. But I want to ask you a question now. And I'll tell you now, I'm going to ask you the same question at the end. And you threw out criticisms and disagreements of the BBC at the beginning. You've got three options here, so I'll give them all first so you know which to vote for. It should be broken up. It should be privatised. It should continue as it is. Who thinks it should be broken up? And I would be thinking of hiving off News and Current Affairs, which is what does it damage. One person thinks it should be broken up. Who thinks it should be privatised? One person. So everyone else actually thinks it should continue as it is.
Or not vote.
Or
the
fourth option then.
Or who thinks it should be wound up? One person thinks
change.
It should be wound up.
Well, I mean, it's doing too much. The 24-hour rolling...
Well, that is broken up.
You mean scaled back?
It should concentrate on what it's best at. And certain things I think it should scale back, but not scale back or break up in the sort of general sense. But it needs to refocus.
How
you
would you do
would
that?
People disagree, would they not, on what it's best at?
Yes. How would you do that? What would be the focus?
Well, I mean,
what do you think it should stop doing? Which channels would you shut?
Right, well, now I said shut, I think the 24-hour rolling news is absolutely dire. It is bland beyond belief. If you contrast it with, say, something like Channel 4 news, Channel 4 news, to use the word bias, is not correct. It has a certain perspective.
What's the difference between a certain perspective and bias?
The difference is that they're not making things up.
The BBC are making things up?
What they do is that you lose focus in what they're reporting because you need a perspective to engage with. That's how you treat somebody as an adult. You say, we are reporting this story. It's quite obvious from the way we're reporting it that we have a certain view about it. That gives you a hook on which to engage, if you like, and have a kind of dialogue with the reporter instead of this bogus idea that we're all children and we have to be spoon-fed some spurious...
Let's pick up on that point, that we're all children and we have to be spoon-fed. I take a different newspaper every day, deliberately. Tuesdays is Telegraph, Thursdays is Guardian. But when something big is on a Tuesday or a Thursday, I buy the other one as well to see what the different perspective is, to use your word. Does that mean... I take the Sun as well. I'm very good with pictures. But what are we, this different perspective, what do we think?
I'm not sure. I mean, when you talk about the BBC Constant News Channel, let's call it that, it has a different role in the BBC and for the nation than Channel 4 News, which is one slot at one time in a given day. Yes. The idea is, and you might quarrel with the execution, the idea is that the people of this country and other countries should have a constant source of reliable news at all times.
You've had your go, David. Let's go to Richard at the back, who had his hand up there. Now, it's very interesting that you as a group think that. However, when we talk about reform, which is a word often used by totalitarian governments of people
Didn't
they
one
want
of
to kill.
Most popular director generals reform constantly?
Who are you thinking of?
Say that again.
One of your less popular. John Burt.
Oh, John Burt.
Yes.
John
constantly
Burt. John Burt was forever reforming and forever reorganising and forever employing management consultants. I'm not
did
against.
Did he achieve anything?
He did achieve things.
Including politically.
By the way.
Okay.
Right.
The fact that there was a lot of unhappiness at the BBC was seen as a very positive thing by the Prime Minister at the time. Okay, so he was sort of judged by the more unhappy people were working for the BBC, the more Margaret Thatcher felt, oh, well, he's getting things right. But also in terms of pure efficiency, he did force through a lot of change. Peter, you were interrupting.
I was saying that reform is often used by totalitarian governments as a way of describing something they want to kill. So you can't reform the BBC if it isn't there. You can't reform it if it's drastically defunded and demoralised. That is what this government, particularly this government, at the end of a line of Conservative governments, is seeking to do. Have you, as a group, gotten across Nadine Dorries? Have you
got...
Yes.
I know what time it is, but we're not having language like that here.
The idea, the cultural phenomenon that is Nadine Dorries, the sorts of things that she says about the BBC.
She's an embarrassment.
She is a major embarrassment to the nation, to the world. But she currently has, by virtue of her being Mrs. Leader of Red Meat Save Big Dog, you know this group, Red Meat for the right wing of her party, Save Big Dog, creating amusements for them. But the fact is, she has her hands on the levers of power. Terrifying, completely terrifying.
She's as thick as a turnip. Yes. have you seen that video of her on YouTube talking about?
There's more than one, actually.
I've seen them all.
Really?
Yes.
It's embarrassing.
It is embarrassing. She is someone who believes you can express strong opinions without knowing anything about the subject you're expressing.
Well, I think there are quite a lot of people like that, if we want to go down that route, but and let's keep it up. Because I'm going to read you a statement here, and then I'm going to ask you where you think it came from.
Yep.
You might say the Daily Mail. Johnson and Dorries are not quite so hostile to the BBC as they pretend. And that statement was 18th of January this year.
I've no idea who said it, but...
It's the byline... to an article.
Right. Where was the article?
That's what I'm asking you.
I don't know.
No, Peter?
Yes.
No.
It's obviously The Guardian.
No, it's Conservative Home.
Yes.
Funny that.
Yeah.
Conservative Home is interesting, and the person who runs it is interesting.
Yes, I know. But do you think this is a bit of a push them, and then we'll get what we really want?
I'm not a politico, so who knows what's really going on? What I do know is that the funding cuts have been enormously... destructive, and they were done without consultation with anyone except in 2015 George Osborne had 5 unminuted meetings with Rupert Murdoch and his people
before he went into the negotiating round with the BBC
and imposed a deep cut. I also know that Nadine Dorries announced the 2-year freeze again, without any consultation with anyone. Now, to be fair, she also announced that this was going to be the last licence fee negotiation because she was going to abolish the licence fee until her cabinet colleagues put her straight and said, I don't think we've discussed that, and I think it's a bit above your pay grade, to be honest. So, she backed down from that. I'd like to pick up a couple of things which have sort of been raised. The 24-hour news, I think that in a world where people are getting more and more of their news from a range of online sources, then there is less value in a rolling 24-hour news TV station. So what the DG is now doing in the latest announcement among the cuts is they are combining the UK 24-hour rolling news with the global 24-hour rolling news, and it will be BBC News. And by the way, you know, we've talked a little bit about bias and so on. An interesting question is if some of you in this room may think the BBC is biased to the left, which would be sort of my guess among some.
That is the usual presumption.
There's no such thing as no bias. The whole thing is a fake idea. The point is that the journalist has a view, and if it's honest reporting, then you can engage with it. But you treat people like children if you assume...
Well, sorry, no, let me just push back there. You're mixing up more than one thing there, okay? The dumbing down will always be a challenge for a mass broadcaster. As it happens, my bete noire is Vox Pops, okay? I don't watch the news live. I only watch the news time-shifted so that I can fast-forward through the Vox Pops. Now, that may make me sort of an extreme... liberal metropolitan elite who is not interested in ordinary people. I am interested in the views of ordinary people, but I like proper research about it. And for the right-wing enemies of the BBC, they must be very disappointed in the great British public. It is true that there's about 30% of people who tend to be older, tend to be socially conservative, who do think the BBC is, and tend to be right-leaning, who do think the BBC systematically is biased to the left. There's a slightly smaller number of mostly socially liberal, younger, left-leaning people who think the exact opposite. And there's a larger group in between who think the BBC is duly impartial and not biased either way. Now, we quote a Telegraph journalist who says there's a loose metaphor, which is the football referee, that the supporters of each side think the referee is biased against their own side. And that, I think, is the fundamental reason why, going right back to certainly 1927, when the BBC became the British Broadcasting Corporation, there's always been this debate with the predominantly right-wing newspapers having the loudest voice, accusing the BBC of being left-wing, and so on. So it's very hard to see how you can avoid having that sort of range of opinions if you're duly impartial. We need to distinguish between that and inaccuracy. And I'm not sure if you were saying that BBC reporting is inaccurate, but...
I'm saying that the idea of impartiality is quite sinister.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
You're right.
Impartiality, accuracy, okay, accuracy is much more measurable than due impartiality, which tends to be...
Accuracy is the word.
Okay, so the BBC, there's, to my knowledge, never been an example of the BBC getting into trouble for being materially inaccurate. They've had a few things which... I'm sorry? Actually what the BBC reported was something they should have made clearer. It wasn't actually inaccurate. We have a whole chapter on the mistakes. Oh, right.
They paid for the helicopters.
That's not inaccuracy. That's a good example of the difference between the two concepts. Okay? So that was a bad judgment. And by the way, the Daily Mail had it both ways on that. They said, outrageous of the BBC. Okay, to do that. But the fact that the BBC has got into trouble about it is really an affront and will reduce press freedom. They had it both ways.
You said a number of interesting things to pick up on there, but I just grabbed one from the cuttings. And this is not from the Daily Mail.
Mm-hmm.
BBC made colossal error over report of bus abuse. The BBC made a colossal error by reporting that victims of an anti-Semitic attack in Oxford Street responded with a slur about Muslims.
Yes.
The BBC just got it totally wrong. And when people have, and it's not just the BBC this is happening, but when people have done that and blown a whistle,
yes,
the BBC seems to react badly to whistleblowers.
They're very defensive, and yes, they circle the wagons.
Yes, they do.
But, you know, if you look at, this is consumed 2 hours a day on average by the British population. How could they not make lots of mistakes?
What percentage of people in the country have cable and satellite television?
About 60.
60, okay. So 40%, yes, have got nowhere else to go.
That's currently about right,
and,
yes.
And therefore that they are consuming more BBC.
Yes, it's a higher proportion of their viewing.
Because,
yes. And probably listening as well.
Yeah, and certainly what it means, I mean, I will often have Radio 2, on, especially if I'm in alone, which is a lot of the time when I'm in, simply because there's noise in the background, and I like the sort of I haven't got to listen to it, I haven't got to worry about it. So I'm in your 2 hours, and probably I've got 3 or 4 hours of that.
No, can we just put that red herring?
Let me come back.
I can talk to you about. I can talk to you for an hour about audience measurement.
Let me come back to you. But you were to justify something. Let me come back to you on what you said about the older conservative person, and that they tend to look at the BBC as having a left bias. That is the group that largely voted for Brexit.
Yes. And it's
and they have had a hell of a lot to say.
No, it's not.
It is more complicated.
Yeah, but they've
put that to one side.
There is a distinct demographic to Brexit. If you look at the demographic analysis of Brexit, of Leave voters as against Remain voters, there is a very clear and entirely unsurprising pattern. Brexit voters were older and considerably and less well educated.
They were also, and here's something fascinating.
Sorry,
you can't say that.
Sorry, you can say
that.
You can say it's
that.
In the
that's,
data.
That's
in
what's
the data.
Sorry. That's what.
Sorry, you can say that.
You can say that. It's social science. You can say it.
I've never been educated in social science.
Brexit, look, it's polls. It works.
Yes.
There is a very considerable demographic difference between Leave voters and Remain voters. And Leave voters were older and less well-educated. They also, and this is a fascinating thing, picked up by a Cambridge study which went across the Western world into people's investments in conspiracy theories. Who believes what mad things? And one of the things that this major study, it hasn't been challenged, which went across the Western world, across the Western world into the USA, revealed was that on the index of what is called the Great Replacement Theory,
the Claim Ranger Bland book,
the big idea that there is an operational plot working in your country to replace the indigenous people with whatever ethnicity that group is worried about. Let me finish. You either accept the findings of science or you don't. You haven't even heard it yet.
Let it finish.
Okay. It's the whole business of Brexit, the resetting of the polls of political debate, and where accusations of bias against the BBC come in. I'll get to that. 31% of Brexit voters were invested in or believed the idea that there was an ongoing plot to replace the white population of Britain with Muslims and introduce Sharia law. Remain voters, about 6% of Remain voters believed in this.
So
if we take Trump's America,
it also means that 70% of people who voted Brexit did not believe.
Yes,
exactly.
We're talking correlations.
However,
we're
talking about
the BBC.
I'm going to get there. Yes. Also, in Trump's America,
the same thing applies.
Now, what people have done, what the BBC's enemies in particular have done, have refocused the political polls around not left or right as we conventionally understood them, but they've sought very successfully to refocus the political polls in this country as between Remain and Leave. And in turn, that means that there is constant scrutiny of the BBC in relation to its coverage of that. Now, there is constant scrutiny from people who tell lies. There is constant scrutiny from people who declare that the BBC is and always has been systematically anti-Brexit in what it does and says. All the proper research says that that isn't the case. And we would add, as a coda to that, the BBC at its highest levels, it is a very cautious, bureaucratic, and government-loving organisation. That's to say, whatever the government of the day is, they like to follow its directions. If the government of the day is a conservative one, that is more so.
Let's just reinforce that. Okay? That is the content analysis, which is sort of peer-reviewed academic research by the group at Cardiff University.
Can I come back?
Yes.
Because I'm sociology and study of relativity. It's not science like physics.
It's
a dismal science like economics. And you're presenting this as absolute truth.
Yeah.
And this is precisely the problem. I mean, on a personal note, I voted to leave the European Union. I was brought up in the north of England. And I can tell you that people in the north are not like that. They're not bigots. They're not really. You can find bigots and racists.
Can I just repeat what Peter said from his statistic, which was that 30% of people who voted leave, as opposed to only 6% of people who voted remain, believe in the great replacement theory. Let me finish. Okay. I said that, which means that 70% of people who voted for Brexit did not believe the great... So we have not said, and certainly the BBC has never said, that Brexiteers are racist and prejudiced and so on. It's much more nuanced than that.
Yes.
Okay?
What you said
it is centrist
okay, no,
in
no,
general.
Paddy, let David come back.
You said that the study was science, and you presented it as science. It is not science, it is statistics. It's a dismal science like economics. And nobody thought that Trump was going to win the election.
Well,
in America.
Okay. We're drifting a little bit away
are,
from the war against the BBC.
Okay,
let's come back onto the
war.
Let's come back onto the war on the BBC.
Well, but this is highly relevant.
Now, you see, you've got a supporter there, you're upsetting.
Right.
Good.
good, says Peter.
I would regard myself as a social scientist, okay? My sort of main field is sort of marketing management. I completely agree that the ability of social scientists to collect data and then predict, particularly change, is quite limited. You know, much to the frustration of marketers who'd love to get market research on radical new products and be able to build factories and rely on the results, and we can't. We have to do much more sort of test and learn. However, if you ask the very neutral question, which one news source do you go to for impartial news? You ask that to the representative sample of the British population. Or the equally neutral question, so either news you trust or impartial news, the BBC completely dominates. It's 50%. Number two is ITV on 9%. And Telegraph below 1%.
Let's accept the principle for the purposes of debate of what you're saying.
Mm.
I'm going to put something to you which I have tested scientifically in 1986 with about 2,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
People basically disbelieve what they read in the papers, hear on the wireless or see on the television.
Mm-hmm.
What they hear in the bus queue, in the supermarket queue or in the pub,
Now on social media,
yes. Fair comment.
Yeah.
The top was on, thank goodness for that. They accept without question. So I think that puts a different slant on people trusting the BBC, because most people don't trust any of the news outlets.
I don't think it does. I think that obviously it's a relative scale. Social media, which didn't exist when you did that research, social media are very, very low down. So they would be at
in
sort
terms
of 2%.
Of trust,
okay. Now there are a situation, say in India, where people rely much more on social media as a source of information, or indeed in the US. I mean, so Peter mentioned one study. There's another study, a York University study, 18 country comparisons, where the dependent variable is the tendency to believe is resilience to online conspiracy theories. The US is in a league of its own. But within Europe, the Nordics, and closely followed by the UK, are the most resilient populations. Southern Europe, so Greece, Italy, and so on, people are much more willing to believe demonstrably untrue conspiracy theories. There are five explanatory variables. One of them is just the size of the country. So the US is a very large and diverse country. Finland isn't. But one of the others is the strength and funding of public service broadcasting.
But it's not,
no,
it's
we're
not
getting quite a bit. We're getting quite a bit away from the war against the
no,
BBC.
No, we're not.
No,
no, we're
it's
not.
Absolutely
and
central.
And I think
David, this
we,
is this
we,
is an absolutely
we,
central
we haven't
issue.
Got a truly representative audience here. Right. But let's take the lady at the back who had her hand up there.
Mm. Yeah, hello. I came here hoping not just to hear statistics or fighting Brexit, but for you with your evidence-based study to talk to us about whether the BBC has any bias, either to the right or to the left, or whether it's that beautiful impartial thing.
So is the BBC
these are fallible human beings.
Yeah, but can we answer the question? Does the BBC have any bias?
Does the BBC have any systematic bias? No. Do they make mistakes? Yes. Do they misreport the news and say things which are inaccurate? Very rarely. I think they may have done in that case, the Israeli case you quote, but that's very unusual. So when people talk about bias, it's much more about the framing of news stories and the selection of news stories. Rather than
well,
the idea
we've got a case
they
of
say things
that
are not
bullshit. Let's have Justin.
Yes, it may well be that there's no systematic bias. Mm. I wonder if there's been any surveys on the political views of the journalists who present them.
Correct.
You're suggesting.
Lots.
I mean, to
very good
great
point.
Controversy. I don't suppose we should enter into it here. Mm. The Middle East. Now, I have a number of Jewish friends who, and the population of Jewry in England is not exactly high, will hardly feature in the statistics that will be taken into account in the overall picture. Mm. But time and again, they've suggested, I don't know whether it's true or not, and I'm not perfectly committed, that the bias is entirely, or almost entirely, against the Israeli position.
Yes, that's been my experience talking to Jewish friends as well. I think they're wrong, but there's no question that's what they believe. But that, I'm afraid, does come back to the football referee analogy. Mm. Okay, that when you have someone whose job, despite being human, is to exercise judgment which is impartial, then each side will tend to think they're biased against their own side.
So does the BBC get the same government criticism when we have a Labour government that it gets when we have a Conservative?
It's very
interesting. Because on the football referee, yes it does, but does it really?
Oh, absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. But in a different way and from a different angle. Mm. We start with three fundamental things about the traditional parties and their views of the BBC. The conservative right, which is the important part of today's Conservative Party,
but is
the
it
conservative
part of every Conservative Party since the war?
Let me finish.
Well, no, actually, that's very, very relevant.
There are three strands in the conservative right's dislike of the BBC. The first is very simply defined. It's ideological. They are against publicly owned public service. They would rather it was private. They would rather it was commercial. That is written into the belief system. That's absolutely fundamental. You hear it again and again about all sorts of things. The second thing is right-wing Tories are very close to people who run commercial broadcasting and media businesses, very close indeed. The reference Paddy made to George Osborne talking to Murdoch before conducting the negotiations which have scuppered the BBC's finances is very central. Let me finish. Mr. Murdoch himself has said that when it comes to Downing Street, he expects to just walk in the back door whenever he wants. That is what he's actually said. The third thing, which is the most alarming thing of all, is that right-wing Tories don't just object to being maligned, as they think. They want to stop the maligners from doing it. So, for instance, give you a very interesting, it's not about the BBC, it's about another public service broadcaster
which this government is attacking, namely Channel 4. In the Edinburgh TV festival of 2019, Channel 4's news and current affairs head talked about the business, the difficult business of getting modern politicians into a room to talk at length, to a real interview of the kind that Margaret Thatcher relished and did all the time. And she said that was particularly true of Boris Johnson. And she also said that Boris Johnson wasn't always completely truthful. And now, this government, and particularly Nadine Dorries, came back saying, you've lost Channel 4 a lot of money there. It's as direct as that. Nick Robinson, interviewing Mr. Johnson on the Today programme, said, faced with an absolute wall of gush, said, Prime Minister, please stop talking. And Nadine Dorries also said of Nick Robinson, you've lost the BBC a lot of money there. It is as direct as that. So they're three strands. Whereas the left is reactive. It is critical of the BBC when things happen, when they think things have been unfairly reported, when they think they've been underrepresented, and so on. They are not engaged in a constant initiative to defund and demoralise the British Broadcasting Corporation. They're not doing that. They might like to reform it. They're very eager to point out the fault line in the BBC's construction, which is it is too much behoven to government, whatever government that is. Whatever government it is, has its hands on the BBC's financial windpipe and always has. And that is a real design fault.
But Channel 4, part owned by the government, part owned by us.
It's completely owned by us.
And nobody is saying that sell-off affects the BBC.
No, it's a separate discussion.
No.
Okay. Yeah, but it is a massively influenced discussion because it would change the impact of sponsorship for the BBC as a commercial entity if that was the decision. What seems to have
sorry,
happened,
don't get that.
Can you just clarify the point you're making?
If Channel 4 was sold off to another commercial enterprise,
yes,
the BBC might choose, rather than the licence fee, to go down the route of just having sponsored programmes.
Ah, okay. I think you're raising a very important issue which we haven't actually covered.
What I'm also saying is that there is this difficulty that the BBC are publicly funded,
yes,
and by the light is, and we're actually ended up with a whole discussion around, it's not about the BBC, it's does the licence fee work?
We're not totally that, but I do want to move on because the BBC gets a lot of criticism. I can think of things and makes mistakes.
How could it not?
Jimmy Savile,
mm-hmm,
Cliff Richard, all sorts of things. Now, I'm going to quote two headlines which are from The Standard, but it's Anne McElvoy, who I don't think would fit into your right-wing category.
She's centre-right. She's the wife of the former editor of the Sunday Times, which is
Murdoch and Blair were pretty pally. The BBC is getting lost in ideological battles and forgetting its real job.
Yes.
More jobs for the boys at BBC and Channel 4... No wonder we're losing faith.
Okay.
Aren't those two things actually
at
the heart of this?
That, of course, raises the very interesting question of, are we losing faith? And so this is a thing which is, among
where
the enemies of the BBC, it's a thing which is often repeated. And it's the Leninist approach. If you keep on saying something which is untrue, you know, maybe enough people will believe it to be true. So is it the case that people's trust in the BBC is going down? No, it isn't. is it the case that people's perceived value for money of the BBC is going down? I can give you a very precise piece of social science about that. Because in 2015, after 5 years, I persuaded the BBC to run what we called a deprivation study, which is where you do, first of all, a screening interview, then you ask people, again, a representative sample of laissez-faire, would you like to have the BBC as it is and pay the licence fee as it is, or no licence fee and no BBC, or less licence fee and less BBC? And what you find in the initial screening interview, and you get slightly better results for the BBC if you ask people to think about it and you ask them again the next day, because they've talked to their families and so on, but what you find with that way of framing it is that sort of 30 to 40% of people say, we don't think the licence fee is good value for money, we'd rather have less BBC and less licence fee, or no BBC and no licence fee. So the follow-up study is then focused primarily, not entirely, but primarily on that large minority of people who say that. You then say, right, we're going to incentivize you a bit to take part in an experiment. And in that experiment, you have to live with no BBC services for 9 days for your household. And at the end, we will give you 9 days license fee. Two-thirds of them changed their mind in 2015. Like, it was 68%.
Yeah, but I think the key point...
No, let me finish, David. Okay.
No, I'm coming back. The key point to that goes to something I asked right at the beginning.
Yes.
About what is the BBC? And the whole of this conversation is largely centred around news and current affairs.
No, that's not what I'm talking about. Sorry, this is not a helpful
interruption.
This is
for the whole thing.
This was the whole BBC. This was not just news and current affairs.
Yeah, but they would have watched... other aspects.
No, this is about the whole BBC and all its services, okay? TV and radio and online, okay? So they lived for 9 days with no BBC, and at the end, in 2015, 68% changed their mind. Late last year, 70% changed their mind. So it's an identical, in fact, very, very marginal, not statistically significant, stronger result. So this idea that, you know, this Anne McElroy nonsense that, you know, people no longer trust it, if only it did what I would like it to do, people would still trust it and still watch it and so on. And, you know, the blessed Nadine has now heard of Netflix and somehow has the idea that because of Netflix, nobody watches the BBC. Okay, it's just not true. And that is very, very evidence-based. The question you raise about funding models is an absolutely key one, and of course we're now about to hear in the next few weeks who is going to be the quotes independent, we shall see, person leading the review of funding models. So there are two reviews about to happen. One is the civil servants at DCMS are going to do the midterm review on governance and all that, but the real crunchy one is about funding models. What's the problem with the licence fee? There are two problems with the licence fee. Three. One of them is it's everyone pays the same. Okay, so it's not a lot of money. Okay, 43 pence per household per day, but it's flat. It's the same for rich households as poor households. Number two that it is increasingly obsolescent to link the funding model to the ownership of a TV set, when people are increasingly consuming the services on multiple devices. Okay. And number three is believed to be that it's expensive to collect, which actually it isn't. But it is the case that more people are refusing to pay, partly encouraged by various lobbying organisations like Defund the BBC and so on. It's a small proportion. Okay. The rational policy question is, what are the alternatives? Advertising has already been looked at, and I'm told, my sources tell me, advertising is an absolute no-no politically this time around. That, you know, Peacock didn't even realise all the reasons why it was a bad idea, but it is a bad idea. General taxation deals with that regressive aspect, because effectively richer people are paying more, but obviously makes the BBC even more vulnerable to politicians, and, you know, that's the sort of big disadvantage. Subscriptions is the one which will be looked at very closely. And the fascinating thing is we've had the IEA and others from Peacock onwards proposing subscriptions for actually 40 years. This thing has been, and they've never actually said what it is they precisely are proposing. Like, you know, how do you pay for radio, BBC Radio? What's in, is it one bundle, is it multiple? And I think that one good thing which I hope happens in the next year is finally, the enthusiasts for subscriptions are going to have to come clean with a clear proposal, and we can start looking at what are the consequences. And the number one consequence is the BBC ceases to be a universally available public service broadcaster. Okay, it's a thing which pulls the country together. Okay, now you may not think that matters. Okay, that's a perfectly justifiable position. But so if, like Margaret Thatcher, you think there's no such thing as society, then you may not care about that. The big crunch, which I think, well, there are two big crunches, which have, the first thing is it literally can't be done until the late 2030s, because in order to have subscriptions, you have to have technology to switch off people who haven't paid, so-called conditional access. And the IEA and so on, if they want subscriptions, they're going to have to come up with, okay, how are we going to achieve that? Okay, probably you need fast broadband, which is not only available across the whole country, but has been adopted at a higher cost than the license fee by all the households who want to consume the services. So that's just a purely technical thing. Supposing you can wave a magic wand, and next Wednesday we've got universally available conditional access so we can do that, as Sky does and so on.
We've got some questions here.
This is a This is a really important issue. I'm sorry. I'm going to sort of cover
that's
the rest.
I'm letting
of it.
You run because there's okay. Lots to pick up on.
The big crunch, which I think the enthusiasts haven't faced up to, is the fact that in order to do subscriptions, if you want to maintain the investment in original British programmes, the price would need to be much higher than the licence fee. Okay, there are two reasons for that. There's an obvious reason which people have spotted, which is if not everyone subscribes, those who do subscribe will have to pay more to make up for that. What they haven't, I think, taken on board yet, but I think this is going to happen in the course of the next year, is this point about Sky's overheads being 80% of the total license fee revenue of the BBC. So it's an incredibly expensive thing to implement, because the Sky has to spend so much on customer service and on marketing. So, and that's even worse if you go for this hybrid thing, the Andrew Neil thing, and saying, well, we're going to have the public service stuff paid for out of taxation, and then only the entertainment stuff paid
or
for this way.
Sorry? All sponsorship.
Yes. The money's just not
there. Okay,
time
is marching, and there's a lot to pick up on there, and there are questions. But the point I was going to make about your survey of people after 9 days is I think the damage is done to the BBC, and this has been borne out tonight, by things in current affairs and news. Yeah. And I bet it was EastEnders and other things that the people actually missed. And
I'm sure that's true.
Let me give you a quote.
Thinks
on
they
it.
Shouldn't be doing that.
Yeah. But this is why we're not looking at the BBC as a whole. Tim Davies battling to restore a reputation for impartiality, and is said to be glad to lose a veteran stuck in her ways.
Who was that?
That was in the Sunday Times.
Who were they talking about?
Who's the veteran?
I think it's Fran Arnsworth.
Yeah. Yes, it is, Fran Arnsworth. Yeah, okay, yep. So I think that sort of addresses a bit. We've got lots of questions. Let's take Justin, and the other hands were up. And Richard, Justin.
I just wonder if we're possibly sort of using too fast a sort of range of weaponry to look at what is actually quite a simple problem that most of us sort of alluded to at the beginning. The problem that people see with the BBC, as I see it, is that there's a lack of objectivity. It's too partial too often. And we don't have to be discussing license fees or whether we completely restructure the BBC. in order to see how you deal with that. And the way I could suggest is a very simple policy change. And it's what David, as the Director General of the European Atlantic Group, normally does. If there is a controversial subject, and there are many, that the BBC is reporting, is it so difficult to try and ensure that there is a spokesman for both sides?
Look, come on.
So do you think, if the BBC addressed the issues as you think they should, that then there'd be no question and argument about the licence fee?
I think they would, to a large extent, it would go away.
It would go away. Okay.
Look, talking about matters of bias, do you know how the British national press is formulated in this matter? The British National Press. Do you know which way it swings most of it politically? What would you think?
I would say this isn't the point. The point is there may well be individual journalists who feel strongly one way. And what sort of a rein is...
But you're talking about the way these things are governed and prescribed for in the way that the BBC is run. Do you know about the various BBC protocols for ensuring balance?
But he's talking about result, outcome.
No, do you have any systematic evidence compiled either by yourself or people close to you who you really value, who can talk about BBC bias? Now, the people who talk about BBC bias are the British National Press. 80% of the British National Press by print sales is A, Conservative supporting on a consistent basis. That is the balance.
Those
are the people, I mean, by print sales, it's the best measure that there is. Just think, who owns the British National Press? Do you know? No, this idea of the BBC's bias is fed to everybody every day by the headlines in the British National Press. It most absolutely is.
That is not what... That is not...
Who owns
them? Peter's going to say... Yeah.
Well, let me, and then you can have your alternative facts. The British National Press, if we take print sales, we're talking about non-dom billionaire Lord Rothermere and family... The Mail Group.
So that's Reach?
Hold on. Then there is Reach, which is a very peculiar commercial organisation, which straddles both sides in a very, very cynical way. It's a public company. But then there is, of course, the Murdoch Empire, which accounts for the Times, the Sunday Times, the Sun, and the Sun on Sunday. And then there is the Telegraph. The Telegraph Group, owned by the one Barclay, the surviving Barclay brother, who lives in, I think, Sark.
Yeah, but I think you'll find that Aidan has something else to say about that.
But this is not addressing Justin's question.
It is addressing your question because... It is addressing your question because you can't actually speak to the bias you think that people believe is exhibited.
Can I try a different sort of...
bias. I don't say that. I say quite unconsciously, without anyone actually directing it, a large rump of BBC reportage comes from individuals, forget the Barclay brothers and all these people, from individuals who consciously or not... And there's a way around that, which is actually quite simple.
Let me tell you something.
Let him finish.
Any survey being conducted about when political hot potatoes are brought on stage, are there or are there not reporters on both sides who can give an account
I'm glad you think that's a simple solution, Justin, okay? Because, of course, it's
impossible
not
to run.
We have to make a distinction. A number of distinctions. One of them is, what are the personal beliefs of the journalists. Now, you've seen Andrew Marr is leaving the BBC. He's
left.
Getting more money.
Yeah.
He's not going to have what he's earning once a year, you know, in the Daily Mail and lots of tooth-sucking about that. But his number one reason that he's given is that he will have finally be freed to express his opinions. So, and I think that as far as the sort of left-right thing is concerned, it's unclear. As far as Brexit is concerned, because the demographics of people voting Brexit are correlated with being more educated and centrist, I would be astonished if the majority of BBC journalists didn't vote Remain. My hunch, you know, we don't have evidence on that, but it would be just because of their demographics, it would be surprising. When we then come to, because you made two other points, one is that to you, a lot of the coverage is, I'm not sure if you're saying obviously biased, but in your view is biased. That comes back to my earlier question of how could we test the validity of your belief? And I've said there are two ways we can test it. One is through academic content research. And what that finds, as Peter said, is that over the last 15 years, the BBC's, insofar as its news reported, has been slightly biased. It's been consistently biased somewhat to be favourable to the government of the day, but slightly more so under Conservative governments than under Labour governments. So that's one source of... indeed, but the okay. I'm saying that this is not a sort of perfect world, okay. But the degree of bias is small, and it's the opposite of what the BBC is usually accused of, okay. On your question of why don't they have rules saying there should always be someone giving the other view, they do, and
that's not what the BBC should be doing. They should be interviewing.
Can I finish, please, Andrew?
Yeah,
okay, they do. And when they do it too much, they are quite rightly accused of going for something called false balance, which is when you give someone saying nutty things one way, someone else saying nutty things the other way, the job of a good journalist is to challenge whoever is making nutty statements. And they don't do that as well as they should. However, nor does anybody else. Now, I'm not talking about the press, okay? No one has ever produced any systematic evidence that Channel 4 News, or, I mean, the style of Channel 4 News is a bit different, same with ITV, but there's no evidence that of systematic skews either way with any of the broadcasters, because in this country, thank God, we have regulations which say that broadcast news has to be duly impartial. The US used to have that, the Fairness Doctrine, and in 1987... the Republicans abolished it, opening the US market to Fox News and shock jock right-wing radio people, okay? Long before Facebook. Obviously, Facebook has massively reinforced the polarization of US society, but it was the abolition in 1987 of the Fairness Doctrine, and that's why the US, that's the single biggest reason, in my view, of why the US is in a league of its own in terms of people believing mad conspiracy theories. You know, television still matters. Putin is relying on television to keep the Russian population on side for his war, and it's working.
We know that, and I could give you examples of sort of second-hand direct experience. You said something interesting there, Paddy.
That's unusual, isn't it?
No, you've said a lot of interesting things. But you said something very interesting, that the BBC will veer slightly to one way under a Labour government and slightly to another way under a Conservative government. You're talking again, which we've centred on throughout, which is interesting in itself. You've centred again on news and current affairs.
Yes.
And we haven't talked about David Attenborough and drama and all sorts of other things.
Yes.
But if I come back to the news, do you think others, you've mentioned Sky, both of you, swing the same way, influenced by different flavour governments?
Not maybe to the same extent.
They don't.
Not maybe quite to the same extent.
Well, we haven't known, not quite the same.
The relationship between Sky and other broadcasters to the government is different.
the government of the day controls the BBC's revenues and is forever, particularly under this government, forever lobbying for their point of view, quite remorselessly.
And Alistair Campbell was trying to pull that one?
No,
of
course he was. But let's come back to the fact that the BBC should be made more politician-proof. But the government of the day is always trying to lobby, and it is trying to lobby more now. And so the
more than in Thatcher times?
Let me get back to that. Because...
No, more than in Thatcher times?
Less, more effectively. And the government
I'm
is...
I'm the illiterate one.
it is lobbying more effectively because the BBC is more scared of it. And that what that means is not that the BBC... not that the BBC lies, presents things inaccurately. When it comes to particular questions that are known to have immense sensitivity for the government, there's what's called a managed risk list.
Yeah.
And if a programme maker at a frontline level is dealing with a subject which is on the managed risk level of thing to do with the government, then it is referred upstairs. And what happens is a wise old head in the BBC's bureaucracy says, best not. It doesn't mean they're going to lie about it. It means they're going to look the other way because that's something they're very frightened of. And so, for instance, you will be aware that Carol Cadwallader, the Guardian stroke Observer journalist, has just won her case against Aaron Banks about libel. During the time that Carol Cadwallader was producing her immensely important work at the Guardian Observer, the government was very disinclined to have it taken out of what we might call the bubble world of the Guardian Observer. So they didn't. They never talked either about her. She was on Andrew Marr once, briefly, ever. So the whole range of things, which included the question of Russian influence in our referendum, was completely put to one side by the BBC because of pressure from this government.
Now, you say that, and I'm going to take Richard's question at the back, and then that's probably going to be the last question, but there was a Michael Cockerell film about Scott. What was his Christian name?
Norman Scott.
Norman Scott.
Yes.
And it was buried by the BBC after he made it for them. Now, there was no political influence from a government there.
How do you know?
Well, because why would they?
I don't know. Okay. So we don't know what the process was. It's interesting. So these...
point is that they will take these decisions on things for commercial, non-commercial reasons.
No, it's not commercial.
Commercial. They don't want to be associated with that.
It's caution.
The very different world of the 1970s, where there was an establishment, you might call conspiracy of silence, about Jeremy Thorpe, who is considered a good chap in every way, these people thought he was their kind of guy, you know, Etonian and all that. Whereas Norman Scott wasn't considered their kind of guy, you know, he was a poor boy and a gay poor boy. So they said, this ghastly, despicable person is trying to blackmail our gorgeous Jeremy Thorpe. And that's why there was a sort of conspiracy of silence in which the BBC, as an establishment entity then, was included. And the BBC is very shy of being considered prurient. So prurient stuff about people's personal lives is stuff it doesn't like to do anyway.
Sure.
Well,
Cliff Richard was an acknowledged mistake.
Yeah.
Acknowledged by them, and acknowledged by us in the book. It's a very...
It's in the chapter on their mistakes.
Let's take Richard's question from the back. What does the BBC mean to us?
Thank you.
But I think, if I may say one point, which is that you slightly overplay it, sort of, I'm not saying you're not just have justification that Nadine Dorries and Boris Johnson, a year from now they might not be in office. And I congratulate to some extent Nadine Dorries on, she's moved the window about the licence fee. And she's effectively said, which all of us know, that in the era of watching on iPads, the licence fee needs looking. So it will outlive her. I think you shouldn't demonise all small C Conservatives. And I think there's a danger. The vast majority of people in this room, the vast majority of people in the country want the BBC to continue. A lot of them might have voted for the BBC. A lot of them might vote Conservatives for the C. They might be very disaffected with the present government, but they don't want to be the BBC. So I just think, in appealing to the war is that we've all got to defend it. It might infuriate us, but we don't want to lose it. And I think we've got to find a language to talk about what is at stake here, not throwing the baby out with the bathwater, not defending everything that we love to death, because it does need to evolve more than it has. And I think that we've got to find that language so that we can think about what might the BBC look like in 10 years. So that people defend the kind of core values of the BBC. Because at the moment there is a very small window. No one's got an answer to how it should be funded.
I do have an answer on how it should be funded.
My question was, what would your answer be?
Okay, I got interrupted before I was able to give the answer. Okay, and actually there are two answers. One of them is the right answer, and the other is the...
wrong answer.
The other is the politically feasible answer. So the right answer is a device-independent universal household fee paid for by all households. And because the one genuine problem with the license fee, which has nothing to do with Netflix, but you know, is sort of fundamental, is that it's flat and rich households pay the same as poor households. If you want to solve that problem, you can make it progressive by linking it to council tax or electricity bills or broadband or something like that. That is perfectly feasible technically over time, and in my view it is the fairest answer. However, one problem with any change to a taxation system is that the people who lose make far more noise than the people who gain. And so something you can guarantee is that quite often the same people who criticise the licence fee for being regressive because it's the same for everyone will be the same people who object to this change because they say, you know, I don't want to pay more than I was paying before. Right? Even though the equivalent of the 43 pence a day, you know, if it goes up to 63 pence a day to a rich household, it is completely trivial amount of money. Okay, so now, this is a rather well-founded assumption. Every politician I've spoken to about it, the Daily Express, when this was even first mentioned, ran a front page story saying, you might end up paying more if they do this. Okay, so no, I'm not making this up. It was confirmed by Whittingdale when I had lunch with him today. Okay, so I think we have strong reasons to believe.
So
the two choices are: you do the fairest thing, which requires statesmanship, something which is not in enormous supply right now. Okay, or you do the politically expedient thing, which is pretty good, and that is a flat universal license fee. That is my answer to Sunday.
Do you want the BBC or not?
No. We're coming down. Peter's going to, we'll call that a closing statement.
Okay.
Peter's going to do his closing statement.
The answer is yes.
When you said,
we shouldn't take it to extremes. The majority of people want the BBC to remain, and that there are a lot of people who are small C conservative who don't want to be vilified. You're absolutely right. Many of my friends are small C conservatives and big C conservatives too. We're not talking about all conservatives. We're talking about the ruling group in this particular conservative government, which is very extreme and very unlike its predecessors in a number of ways. There's been a change in the balance of conservative power. That's the important thing. It can all, and just to go on, what you're talking about, it can all be solved with good faith. The reason we called it the war against the BBC is because there's an awful lot of bad faith about. There are people who present technological or other problems as if they were insoluble. That's what I call bad faith. The people who are attacking the BBC systematically are exercising bad faith. They want to defund and demoralise it. You have to recognise that, or you won't get anywhere. It's depressing to think that a significant, powerful group of our fellow Britons wants to do this. We didn't... Let me finish this... Yes. Mm. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. But the book, the question has been asked. The book came out in 2020.
Yeah, November 2020.
So the research and work on the book was done before the current office holders came.
The words Nadine and Doris do not appear.
And if we take Richard's point, they are a little window. They've arrived and they're going to go.
We've published quite a lot since. And what we're talking about, I mean, and you said in the introduction, some of this, hasn't there always been a war against the BBC? The answer is yes, including, I mean, Blair has the distinction of being the only PM who has caused both the chairman and the DG to be forced out of office. Okay.
Does that put a slant on blaming right-wing Tories?
No, it doesn't. Because there is a consistent bias over the decades for strong structural reasons. The Tories are against publicly owned public sector organisations.
Some Tories.
It's part... look, once upon a time, there were Tories who believed in a mixed economy. That is not the dominant group in the Tory party now. Second, there are commercial interests at work which were much more marked in Tory support than in Labour support. And third, the Tories are much more totalitarian about squashing a negative comment, as we see demonstrate. All this could be solved with good faith. You know, it doesn't... The license fee doesn't have to be got rid of tomorrow. There are ways that grown-ups sitting transparently, so to speak, and that's the important thing, could arrive at the funding answer for the BBC that would answer all our requirements about bias, about being politician-proof. It's all doable with good faith. We call it a war because there has been an enormous amount of very bad faith.
Is the BBC up for doing that? Sitting down and having that conversation?
No, the BBC doesn't have a choice.
Is
it up for
Will the BBC engage with the review? Of course.
Right.
Of course. I mean, it always engages.
Will that review...
I would question that. I think, would the DG of the BBC... Tim Davey at the moment engaged with that? No, because he has far more important issues about pretending to protect his job than actually what you and I would like to discuss, about the focus of the BBC.
I thought the question was, you know, we've got these two reviews about to start.
Yeah,
okay, one is the DCMS review, which is the midterm review. The BBC didn't want that to happen, but it's going to happen. The other, which I think is actually more important, is the independent review, quotes independent, let's hope, which we hope is going to be in good faith, of funding models. My view is that there are only two good answers. One of them is a flat universal license fee or household levy, and the other is a progressive one. My expectation is they would end up going for the flat one, and just for politically pragmatic reasons. Will the BBC engage in those two reviews? Yes. I mean, why on earth wouldn't they?
They're obliged to.
In good faith was the point. Okay.
They are obliged to.
We have overrun enormously, but that matters not. We've certainly had a decent discussion, I think we can say.
Do you sometimes have indecent discussions?
What I found in
burlesque,
yeah, whatever bit of that, we'll put our old next time, frilly next knickers time. On and hats, and yeah.
Here comes Carol Stone.
Hotly followed. No. God, that's a thought. I know. What I found fascinating is that we have constantly come back to the licence fee. Mm-hmm. Rather than content of the BBC and all the other things,
but
such
we've
as
we've talked a lot about bias.
So let me put the question again: who thinks it should be broken up? By which I mean splitting current affairs and news, which seems to cause all the argument.
I understand.
From all the other things.
Could that be a solution then?
Well, do you think that? Who thinks that? And the BBC continues to make all its Attenborough films and its drama and all the other things.
Programs are pretty good, and I know people who watch Sky and all that prefer. I'm so used to watching the BBC, I've got a bit lazy. But there seem to be some quite good alternatives. And news is news, you know.
Who thinks it should be privatised?
Well, privatised is the other option. If you don't break it up and separate the news, then privatise it.
So we haven't basically moved the audience either way on any of that. And who thinks it should continue as it is?
Reformed. Yeah.
No. Continue as it is. You're referring. So we got not much enthusiasm for. But so reform is needed. Is that what we think?
Yeah.
But reform doesn't mean splitting news and current affairs off from everything else.
I would vote for Peter York to run it.
Me too.
God help us. God help
Paddy's
us.
Paddy's just resigned.
So you do want it broken up and destroyed.
Well.
So what is going to happen? What do you think will happen?
Death of a thousand cuts.
Yes, that's been
the death of a thousand cuts. That's has the been the strategy of this government and its predecessors. It has very significantly defunded the BBC. That process is continuing with the licence fee freeze for the next 2 years. That will add one chocolate button's worth of payback to every household per week.
I think it's about
however,
ten chocolate buttons. But
ten chocolate buttons.
Ten. I've got ten.
Yes.
15, 20, I'll
in
ten.
Other
it's
words,
a, it's a new gas meter.
It's, yeah, it's very little, but it will take 250 million out of the BBC's operating income that could be put into programmes or people.
And of course, if we believe opinion polls, 2 years, we could be past the next general election and the whole lot could be back in the melting pot because we've had a change of political
party. It's actually
party.
A myth that the polls aren't reliable. It's the, but that's a that's
yeah, yeah,
no
I was,
story,
see,
but,
I was
yeah.
being a little naughty with that.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
yes.
A little naughty.
We won't go
in other words, we've got 2 years of, in your view, uncertainty.
Oh, no, we've got... there will always be uncertainty.
No, uncertainty about the long term. Mm.
No, I think we've got these two reviews, and I'm actually looking forward to what happens when the people proposing subscriptions finally, after 40 years, have to say what exactly are they proposing and what do they think
well,
the costs and consequences
What we've done
be.
Is come back again to the cost... not to the bigger picture. But of course, we're living in a situation where millions of people across the world are rapidly cancelling their subscriptions to all sorts of things. Because they're skint.
Yes, I think that the BBC it's an incredibly strong brand, and it's an incredibly important part of most people's lives. So, for instance, with licensing, one thing which is why should households pay for it if they don't consume the services? Okay, the household reach of the BBC's total services, the only time it's been measured, it's quite difficult to measure. In 2015, it was 99%. 99% of households, one or more people, were using one or more BBC services in the course of a week. So the idea that there's a material number of people in the course of a whole year who get nothing for their 159 quid, you know, that is clearly nonsense. So I think we're going to have a version of managed decline. And if the enemies of the BBC continue to be in charge, that decline will be faster and it'll be death of a thousand. If Nadine Dorries said, we're going to abolish it next year, and that was the government's position, the backlash would, I mean, the poll tax riots would seem like a, you know, mere curtain raiser. Okay. Actually, if you try to switch to subscriptions before everyone's got conditional access, they say, terribly sorry, you can't access the BBC anymore because you haven't got that. You know, just imagine the backlash. Okay, so it's the only threat to the BBC is funding cuts. Of course, there are others, but you know, like competition from Netflix and so on. They have to spend more on distribution than before because they've still got broadcast and they've got to spend on online distribution. But the big threat is the government's funding cuts, and I'm not a political, I don't know how much that will continue, but the trajectory is this extraordinary thing which no other country has, which sits at the heart of this incredibly successful broadcasting ecosystem, which itself sits at the heart of our incredibly successful creative industries, is being slowly and deliberately destroyed through funding cuts.
Do you think breaking news and current affairs away from everything else would change that?
No.
No.
I mean, it's a hypothetical question,
yes.
But...
Well, No.
It's not only about news and current affairs. It's ideological.
It seems to me, I'm a journalist, and it seems to me that people are not able to look at the BBC generally as apart from... They can't separate the news and current affairs from the rest, from the orchestras, from the drama, from all the other wonderful things that... So, in having listened to you and the whole thing, I think that hiving the news and current affairs off as a separate entity would then force it to stand on its own, on its merit, in comparison to Sky, which is also very good journalistically, and
yes.
Channel 4, whatever. Mm. Journalistically, they're great, but let them stand on their own, because if you hive it off and separate it, then you have to look at it on its merit rather than in the whole.
What do you mean by merit?
Yes, I think.
And what do you mean?
What is merit?
Yes. All we've heard about is bias. If I'm Jewish, it's pro-Palestinian. If I'm this, it's pro-conspiracy. And that doesn't affect all of the other wonderful things that the BBC does as an institution.
Yes.
But it affects people's perception of the whole.
The attacks on the BBC, there's a whole strand of attacks on the BBC, which actually came out of the quote you used at the top, the James Murdoch quote about the scope, that Rupert and James Murdoch in particular have always pushed this line that the right solution to public broadcasting is what they have in America, okay? And no one spends much political capital attacking PBS and NPR in America because they're very small.
And they're publicly funded by people who want to put their own money into it.
There are very few people in America or this country who would think that's a better system.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
And actually, you mentioned Sky. If you want to see the benefits of the UK regulation for due impartiality, not just for the BBC, but for all broadcast news, compare Sky News when it was part of the Murdoch Empire, with Fox News when it was part of the Murdoch Empire, okay? Same shareholder, okay? And deregulated in the US, and Fox News, you know, there's abundant evidence that Fox News has had a huge influence in terms of the polarization of the US, which ended up with 6th January and all of that. But part of the same organization before he sold it was Sky News, which is very high quality and duly impartial, as is ITV, as is Channel 4 News, as is Channel 5 News, as is Radio News. Okay, so that's what we kind of take it for granted, but you have then to look at sort of the BBC as a whole and the extraordinary value for money it provides, which is then taken for granted, which is why we ran the deprivation study. It's only when the people who criticise the BBC a lot are forced to live without it, just for 9 days, and, you know, people don't like admitting they were wrong, so, you know, a third of them didn't, but two-thirds of that large of minority changed their mind. That's pretty successful.
I still come back to wanting to know what it was they missed. But we have to draw it to a conclusion. It has been engaging, I think, is the word that I would use. And in the true spirit, we will adjourn to the bar. Yes. But Peter, Paddy, thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank you, not just... thank you not just for being here, but for having the passion to write the book that you've written, to make us all discuss what is an incredibly important part of Britain. I must admit, I was sitting here thinking, well, in 40 years' time, we could be back here doing this, but maybe we won't because Andrew Lloyd...
We'll be dead.
No, we won't be dead, Paddy. Andrew Lloyd Webber might have written a musical, What Do You Do About a Problem Like the BBC?
Oh, that's possible,
And we'll look at it in a completely different way. How do you solve a problem? Okay. But thank you all for coming. As I say, it's been the first in person, and I can tell you it's a hell of a lot better than things online.
For sure.
Going to move forward with this concept, and if you think we've had a little bit of sort of scratching around the edges and niggling people tonight, might go something better, which is going to be on the 19th of October, if it's here. And that is the NHS, sacred cow or tethered goat.
Very good.
So thank you all for coming. Thank you, Paddy. Yeah. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, David.
Remember to buy your book. They're a tenner. They're a discount. And you will get it signed by both of them. Can I say you'll get it signed by both of you?
Yes.
That is brilliant.
Is that mine then? Well, thank you, Peter.
Thank you.
Good. Have you brought the pen, Peter? Because I haven't.
I can do your pen. Thank you, Paddy.
Very good, David. Well, it was very good indeed. Both very, very, very
simple. I only got halfway through my newspaper cuttings.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much.
It's always interesting to see where those cuttings come from.
You're digging out a pen.
I'm digging out a pen.
No, that's only a pencil.
No, it's a pen. I think
this is a pencil. That's
right.
A pen.
Right. Yes.
You got a pen.
Yes.
Very good indeed.
Good faith is at the heart of this.
Yeah.
When we started naming it, at what people thought was rather a melodramatic way, we didn't know quite how much war there was.
Thank you, Peter.
What's your name?
Richard.
Very good, Peter. So, and then that was, well, if anyway, most 99.9%.